I'm James Myers, host of Plato's Pod, and in this episode, Michael Fitzpatrick returns to discuss with me Plato's seventh letter. Plato wrote 2,400 years ago, and in the fifth season of Plato's Pod, we're aiming to bring his philosophical principles and observations about human nature into the 21st century, applying them to current political and social issues around the globe. In looking for and finding many connections, we don't take partisan positions, and we don't mention names in our dialogue. Today is February 17, 2025, and this is the first of several episodes on Plato's letters, beginning with his best-known seventh letter. It's an extraordinary recounting of Plato's own philosophical engagement with the politics of his time, one in which he encountered both success and failure. We've divided the readings from Letter 7 into two main categories, and today, after Michael provides an overview of the historical setting that Plato was writing about, we'll look at the first theme. The seventh letter features two characters, the tyrant Dionysius, who ruled Syracuse, and the philosophically minded Dion, who was persecuted by Dionysius. And we'll begin by focusing on Plato's depiction of the ills that befall the city whose rulers do not practice philosophy. Such rulers are plain to see today, as they were 2,400 years ago. In a few weeks, we'll consider the second theme of Letter 7, which is the question, can virtue be taught? We'll see that Dionysius and Dion represent different answers to the question that was central to Plato's dialogue, the Meno. As always, we invite listeners to reflect on and respond to the topics that we discuss. We'd love to know what you think and welcome your suggestions for future topics. Please email your thoughts and comments to dialoguesonplato@outlook.com, and if you'd like to join in future discussions, please let us know. In the meantime, we're so glad you've chosen to share your time with us today. Well, welcome back to Plato's Pod, Michael. I'm really excited to begin our discussions on Plato's seventh letter today. And thanks to you for suggesting that. I hadn't actually read the letter before, but I found in it some remarkable connections to Plato's Republic.
Hello, James. I'm excited to be here, and I really love this letter, so I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Well, it's great. And, you know, I also found many connections between the characters in Plato's letter, particularly Dionysius, the tyrant who led Syracuse, and some modern leaders. And again, this is kind of bringing Plato into the 21st century. I think in many ways, the seventh letter is an observation on human nature that really hasn't changed in the 2,400 years since Plato wrote it. And so, you know, as I read the seventh letter, I couldn't help thinking of Plato being like the prisoner in the cave of his famous allegory in the Republic, as Plato describes his interactions with the closed-minded Dionysius and philosophically inclined Dion. In the allegory of the cave, the prisoner escapes the cave's world of shadows and false images to see the true light of reality, but he's forced back into the cave to lead the other prisoners to truth. And so as Plato relates his efforts, tries to impart some philosophy on Dionysius in three visits to Syracuse, the tyrant seems to behave like the other cave dwellers that the allegory warns of, those who refuse to turn away from the false images that are playing on the wall in front of their eyes. So yeah, it's a really interesting letter. So while Plato succeeds in his mission to introduce philosophy to Dion, he fails with Dionysius. And he recounts the whole story in the seventh letter that he's addressed to the friends and followers of Dion. So I thought before we begin discussing the key themes of the seventh letter, could you give us some of the historical background on the events and the people that Plato describes in the letter?
Yeah, sure thing, James. As you said, we're discussing what is probably the most famous of the letters attributed to Plato, the seventh letter. And before we can really appreciate the content in this letter, we have to address two historical contextual questions. The first is why we're justified in thinking this letter was written by Plato. And the second is what is the historical background to the topics and themes discussed in the letter. All historical texts have to be interrogated for their authenticity because imitating a famous person of history in epistolary writings was a common ancient practice. We have 13 letters that are attributed to Plato, yet historians are very confident that at least some of them are imitations by students or admirers of Plato. Careful analysis of their writing style and implied philosophical commitments are discordant with Plato's own voice and beliefs. So we cannot take for granted that a letter purporting to be written by the Greek master actually was. Of all the letters believed to be authentic, the seventh letter has historically been the most confidently attributed to Plato. Now, my aim is not to give a summary of the scholarly debate around the letter, but simply to share with listeners my own reasons for accepting the seventh letter as being from the hand of Plato. I have three reasons. The first is that the level of detail we are given about Plato's adventures and misadventures in Syracuse exceed anything we find elsewhere in the historical record. And an astonishing amount of the interior reflection in this letter showcases how those events would have been interpreted by Plato himself. And it's hard to imagine having a source other than the person who experienced those events firsthand to have written this. As I've joked with students in the past, if Plato didn't write the seventh letter, then there was a perfect carbon copy of Plato running around Athens writing letters in his name. In other words, it reads like the kind of letter Plato would have written if he had sent the followers of the executed Dion to explain his role in the death of his friend. Second, we have no historical evidence or testimony suggesting who the brilliant imitator would have been if the seventh letter wasn't written by Plato. When the famous Plato scholar Miles Burnett declares the letter inauthentic in his edited volume on the topic, Nicholas Pappas responded in a 2017 review of the volume, "So who is that masked writer, that astonishing figure who invented autobiographical correspondence and who all but invented the prose tragedy?" Attributing the letter to an anonymous genius who otherwise was invisible to the historical record seems extraordinary. No one has been able to come up with likely suspects from Plato's academy or network of friends. Ariel Helfer concludes in his 2023 volume on Plato's letters, quote, "Is attribution of the seventh letter to Plato himself not by far the most parsimonious and credible explanation in this regard?" End quote. Moreover, the letter is a sort of first of its kind, inaugurating a form of epistolary autobiography that has no precedent from that time period. An earlier classicist, Arnoldo Momigliano, I'm probably mispronouncing that, so apologies to Italians out there. He observed in 1971, quote, "We do not know of any autobiographical letter comparable to Plato's seventh letter before Plato. I am reluctant to admit that forgery preceded reality in the matter of autobiographical letters. The letter seems to me an exceptional creation by an exceptional man, namely Plato," end quote. My third and last reason for accepting the letter as genuine comes from having read the dialogues of Plato many times over. When we read widely in an author, we tend to get a feel for their voice, for the kinds of concerns they have, the stylistic moves they make. The first time I read the seventh letter, I didn't know anything about the scholarly debate concerning its authenticity. I simply read it, and it immediately struck me as sounding like Plato. It had the ring of truth from his dialogues, that extraordinary mix of philosophical ingenuity and astonishing humility at his own fallibility, and the importance of dialectic rather than deference with respect to his own voice. The claims about the practice of philosophy, the aspirations for seeing concrete political transformation, his deep desire to demonstrate the pragmatism of idealism, and his brutal confession as to the repeated failures to bring about the transformation he hoped, all bear the marks of a writer, of the writer of the aporetic dialogues and the hopeful dialogues on politics that we know and love. With that, I want to turn to just saying a few things about the historical circumstances that we will hear Plato referring to in our discussion today. The seventh letter was most likely written about 9 years before Plato's death in 347 BC. In it, he refers to Sparta's brutal defeat of Athens, which led the city to turn against the divided, democratic institutions of the city-state, and that led to the rise of the so-called 30 tyrants, which included Plato's own family members. Now, he was a young man at this time, but he was still politically naive, and he hoped for their success, that they would bring justice and a recovery of his homeland. Instead, what he encountered was a deep disappointment as the rule of the 30 was corrupt and oppressive and led to a massive purge of political enemies and financial competitors to the ruling class. That, of course, led to rebel groups forming and rising up to depose the 30 tyrants, but those rebel groups then in turn engage in their own purge of the supporter of the tyrants. A young Plato is witnessing all of this ongoing cycle of civil war and violence as the Democrats and tyrants struggle for control of Athens. It was with the death of Socrates, his teacher and friend, that Plato finally abandoned his hopes to effectuate justice in the city-state directly through political service. For, as he says in our seventh letter, without right philosophy, a state will suffer under bad governance and corrupt laws. So, Plato became an educator and would go on to found the world's first university. Even before founding the Academy in Athens, Plato had already become famous as a luminary there, and in 385 BC, the Sicilian ruler Dionysius I invited Plato to his court in Syracuse, as he liked to rub elbows with noteworthy Greeks from the mainland peninsula. At this time, Plato was probably already had completed the trial and death of Socrates' writings and an early version of the Republic, so he was thinking deeply about political topics. When he arrived at Syracuse, he was disgusted both by Dionysius's despotic rule and by the rampant hedonism he encountered both there and on his journey to the city. However, while at the tyrant's court, he also met Dionysius's brother-in-law, Dion, who would have been in his early 20s at this time. Dion quickly became a student of Plato's and an admirer of his philosophical work on political justice. Dion desperately wanted to liberate Sicily from Dionysius's rule. These two would remain in touch for the next 30 years, and Dion made occasional visits to see Plato in Athens. However, Plato's first visit in Dionysius's court came to a harsh end. Because he spoke frankly about the injustice of Syracuse's politics, the tyrant had Plato arrested and sold into slavery. It was only due to his well-known fame and his network of friends that he was ransomed by Anicerius of Cyrene and set free. It was after this experience that Plato's patrons helped him to found the Academy. He spent the next 2 decades teaching, giving occasional public lectures, and writing his masterful dialogues. It was as a much older man that he found himself invited to return to Syracuse. Dionysius I had passed away, and the kingdom was now ruled by his son and heir, Dionysius II. Moreover, Plato's old friend Dion had become an intimate advisor to the ruler. Dion thought this was the right time for the kind of political transformation that he and Plato had dreamed of together over the years, and that Plato had argued for so eloquently in his dialogues. Dionysius needed someone to teach him how to be a ruler in accordance with the form of justice, and Dion warned Plato that if he didn't come teach the young tyrant, far worse people would, namely sophists. Wanting to help his friend and also wanting to practice what he had preached, Plato set sail for Sicily once more in 366 BC. Unfortunately, Dion and Plato were unable to overcome palace intrigue. Dion's competitors suspected him of conspiring with Plato to depose the young tyrant and to install Dion as the ruler in his stead. Over several months, a conspiracy was hatched to plant disinformation in the mind of Dionysius II and turn him against Dion. The plot proved successful, and Dion was exiled to Italy, with his sizable wealth in Sicily seized. Surprisingly, Dionysius did not turn on Plato. He had a high regard for his foreign teacher and actually wanted to earn Plato's praise and admiration. But Plato would come to see that Dionysius cared more for the praise of Plato than he did the praise of Lady Philosophy. This became evident as Dionysius became jealous of Plato's steadfast loyalty to Dion and his unwillingness to denounce his friend as a traitor. Plato was eventually successful in getting the tyrant to allow him to return to Athens and to release Dion's estates, and even promised to someday allow Dion to return to Syracuse. Plato went home, but in 361 found himself summoned once more to Sicily by the tyrant, and again without Dion receiving permission to return with him. Plato refused again and again, citing his advanced age at this point. Plato would have been approaching 70 by this time. Finally, the tyrant threatened Plato, saying if he came, all would be settled with Dion, but if not, the tyrant would permanently dispense with Dion's assets and arrange for him to be killed. Now, this didn't sound like a philosophically minded ruler to Plato, but fearing for Dion's life and still somewhat hopeful that he could convert Dionysius to philosophy, Plato finally relented and sailed to Sicily. What resulted was an astonishing betrayal. Dionysius broke all fellowship with Dion and essentially kidnapped Plato, holding him prisoner in Syracuse, in part because he feared for his reputation abroad if he let Plato go home to tell the truth about what was happening. Eventually, Plato learned of a plot in the city to have himself assassinated, and once again, with the help of friends, was able to flee the city in secret and escape. He immediately sailed to Olympia, where Dion was attending the games, and informed him that Dionysius was a false friend and intended to honor none of the assurances made to Dion or his allies. Plato returned to Athens, but Dion raised an army and invaded Syracuse, taking the city and sending Dionysius into exile. Plato corresponded with his friend and encouraged him to make reforms in conformity with justice. While in his 3 years of rule, Dion did aim for a Platonic approach to politics, the period was turbulent, marked with conflict between many rival factions, and in the end, Dion was himself assassinated. His killer, Callippus, set himself up as a new tyrant, and Sicily found itself once again under the jackboot. Plato compared his friend Dion to a ship's captain who correctly anticipates that a storm is coming, but underestimates the destructive power of the storm. He grieved the death of Dion immensely. These are the circumstances that Plato is reflecting upon in this letter. They are full of passion and intrigue, but also philosophical lessons. One of the most remarkable things about this letter is that Plato sees each experience as something to learn from, and by the end of the letter, his optimism that justice really can be achieved on the earth is not diminished. He simply accepts that, perhaps like Moses gazing from the mountaintop into the promised land, he will not live to see the just society for himself. But he hopes those who carry on his memory and Dion's will pick up the pieces where they failed and continue the work.
Well, thank you. That's a great summary of a very rich history. And one thing that really struck me about Dion's approach, and Plato says this a number of times in the letter, is that it's better to be honest than to give in to the system. And I think that's something that clearly was reflected in Socrates, and I see that being reflected in Dion too. And it's really an interesting scenario where there's a philosopher, Plato. He's going into the city and actually practicing, putting into practice the philosophy, a lot of which is talked about in the Republic, as I mentioned earlier. And it's really interesting to see, the character Dionysius, the tyrant. There's a number of things that he says about Dionysius. Dionysius has no friends, for example. This is how tyrants work, right? They operate out of fear. And it's really interesting the way he talks about that. And we see, leaders who are like that, who operate out of fear now. And it's really interesting. So I think it is that this commentary on human behavior and the behavior of leaders and that real contrast between Dionysius and Dion is just so stark and so wonderful. So let's see where we go with this. So what we did in discussing this episode before, to break it into two major themes, and I think maybe we'll get to one of those themes today. So the two themes that we thought of were first the ills that befall the city whose rulers do not practice philosophy. And this is something that is talked about in the Republic as well. And we see this in Syracuse. The other theme, which I don't think we'll get to today, but we'll get to in our next discussion, is can virtue be taught? That was the question of the dialogue, the Meno. And I think we see in this letter that Plato cannot teach virtue, and it's not his fault. It's the student, Dionysius, just simply will not open his eyes. As I said in the introduction, he's kind of like the prisoner in the cave who Plato is trying to introduce him to the light of the truth, and he just will not see the light of the truth. He's too stuck in that factionalism.
One really important thing that our listeners should keep in mind is for Plato, everything comes down to what do you love? If you're going to be a true philosopher, you have to love wisdom. And what you all should listen for in these readings is that in the end, Dionysius is loves reputation more than wisdom. He cares what Plato thinks about him, what the Sicilians think about him, what foreign elites think about him. He doesn't care about wisdom for its own sake.
Yeah, excellent. Very much so. And we'll see this throughout the selections that we've made to read. I just wanted to say maybe one thing before the first selection that we have from the letter, but just one thing with respect to whether the letter is real or not. And I thought maybe we could start our next discussion on this because it's this wonderful section from, it's about 341b to 343b in the letter. And that's the famous part where Plato says that he never puts his thinking into writing. And then this wonderful exposition that he almost 2 pages worth, where he talks about a lot of the philosophy that's embedded in all of his dialogues. And that's why, as you say, I mean, as I read this, I saw Plato's voice throughout it, and his voice rang out so loudly in those in that section in particular. So maybe we can talk about that next time at the beginning. But yes, let's dive into the discussion today and the first theme of the ills that befall the city whose rulers do not practice philosophy. And it's really reminiscent of, I think, the Republic 473d, where the same point is made. The point that no city will escape evils until it's ruled by philosophers or the rulers adopt philosophy. So I'll just start this reading at 325d to 326d. The more I reflected upon what was happening, upon what kind of men were active in politics, and upon the state of our laws and customs, and the older I grew, the more I realized how difficult it is to manage a city's affairs rightly. For I thought it was impossible to do anything without friends and loyal followers, and to find such men ready to hand would be a piece of sheer good luck, since our city was no longer guided by the customs and practices of our fathers, while to train up new ones was anything but easy. And the corruption of our written laws and our customs was proceeding at such amazing speed that whereas at first I had been full of zeal for public life, when I noted these changes and saw how unstable everything was, I became in the end quite dizzy. And though I did not cease to reflect how an improvement could be brought in our laws and in the whole constitution, yet I refrained from action, awaiting the proper time. At last I came to the conclusion that all existing states are badly governed and the condition of their laws practically incurable, without some miraculous remedy and the assistance of fortune. And I was forced to say, in praise of true philosophy, that from her height alone it was possible to discern what the nature of justice is, either in the state or in the individual, and that the ills of the human race would never end until either those who are sincerely and truly lovers of wisdom come to political power, or the rulers of our cities, by the grace of God, learn true philosophy. He continues, such was a conviction I had when I arrived in Italy and Sicily for the first time. When I arrived and saw what they call the happy life, a life filled with Italian and Syracusan banquets, with men gorging themselves twice a day and never sleeping alone at night, and following all the other customs that go with this way of living, I was profoundly displeased. For no man under heaven who has cultivated such practices from his youth could possibly grow up to be wise. So miraculous a temper is against nature, or become temperate, or indeed acquire any other part of virtue. Nor could any city enjoy tranquility, no matter how good its laws, when its men think they must spend all on excesses, and be easy going about everything except the feasts and drinking bouts and the pleasures of love that they pursue with professional zeal. These cities are always changing into tyrannies or oligarchies or democracies, while the rulers of them will not even hear mention of a just and equitable constitution. So I thought maybe we could just discuss that part a bit and maybe the resonances with the Republic, but maybe also resonances with modern times. And in terms of, as he talks about his arrival in Syracuse, as you said in your historical background, I mean, it was kind of perhaps a materialist society, a society that valued drinking in excess more than it valued wisdom and more than it valued virtue. Except in Dion, I don't think he discovers virtue in Syracuse. I can't recall any part in the dialogue where he talks about that, where he refers to other virtuous citizens in the city. And so, I just wonder how this, again, this thought about how the statement that the ills of the human race would never end until either those who are sincerely and truly lovers of wisdom come into political power, or the rulers of our city, by the grace of God, learn true philosophy. And that really maybe speaks to today. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think you're quite right that that line is almost a direct extrapolation out of the Republic. At the time that he was in Syracuse, most scholars think he had like a shorter version of the Republic written. So he was already developing some of those major themes. And I think his core insight here is that philosophy and power have to coincide for there to be justice. Now, he doesn't mean go to the academic guild, find professional philosophers, and put them into power. That's not what he means. What he means is until leaders care more about wisdom for society and goodness in their own souls, that is, the practice of virtue. A political economy is just going to be a competition of interests, of one faction trying to get leverage over another faction. And so justice, and now I'm putting scare quotes around it, just becomes whatever the strongest faction wants. Of course, what Thrasymachus would call the advantage of the stronger. And so Plato is looking around this, not just in Syracuse, but of course the whole Thessalian Peninsula, which was in a similar state of disrepair, and he was seeing this constant falling into civil war, into trying to depose tyrants or to raise tyrants up because the democracy had become completely dysfunctional, which is a trend that we see in our world today. And he was saying, if we really want political stability, if we really want, as ordinary people, to be able to count on tomorrow and not have to fear for food insecurity, housing insecurity, or invading armies, the only way we're going to achieve that is to have leaders who practice virtue in their own lives and who use their power only for the sake of the common good and not for their own gain.
Yeah, and there's a really interesting line. I just I've marked it somewhere in the dialogue, and I can't remember exactly where it is, where he talks about how a truly good leader, even if the leader is a tyrant, would, when taking over a city, would not mistreat the people, could still demonstrate power, but the people would follow because the leader reflects virtue as well as power. And he says it makes that sort of leader doubly powerful, whereas a leader like Dionysius pretends to be powerful, but I think he is perhaps really weak. And these repeated references to how he doesn't have any friends, he couldn't find any friends to govern different areas of Syracuse, and so he's somebody who has no option but to deal with factionalism.
Yeah, and the other thing that your comments made me think about and that came up as we were reading is this focus on the materialistic and hedonistic lifestyle. So the tyrant doesn't get to indulge themselves very much. They spend too much time anticipating plots, worried about palace intrigue, raising armies, going to war, and so on. But everybody else in the society, there's almost a sense in which they fall into the hedonistic lifestyle because it's the only way to distract oneself from the oppressive political reality that they live in. And a lot of commentators have observed today that that's kind of how capitalist economies tend to work, that you have the working class who is exhausted by the end of the workday. And so we have to come up with little bits of mindless stimulus for them to want to sleep and get up for the next workday. And so we give them Netflix and we give them candy and, lots of little shots of stimulation that don't actually provide any substance for their soul or make them a better person, or most importantly, lead to any kind of transformation of their political reality. They're sort of enslaved to this ongoing working class grind. So I think that's an interesting connection to make between our modern industrial and computerized environment and this Syracusian hedonism that he's describing here.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, actually. And it really speaks again to that line that I read Nor could any city enjoy tranquility, no matter how good its laws, when its men think they must spend their all on excesses. I guess we have a society now in the capitalist system where there is so much debt. Debt is maybe the sign of excess, right? That we are living beyond our means, and we've kind of mortgaged the future. We'll never be able to repay the debts that we've accrued, but we're enjoying, or supposedly enjoying, the excesses. It makes me think of our discussions and our many episodes on the laws, this idea that the better city is one whose citizens and leaders are virtuous. And so here, Plato is trying to get the leader to be virtuous. But I think the whole letter kind of shows how that's not really possible. Now, how the citizens would become virtuous if the leader isn't virtuous and there's all of this excess, I guess, is really a question. I don't know what the solution would be. I'm not sure that Plato's aim in this was really anything beyond trying to convert Dionysius. I don't recall any part in the letter where he's trying to convert other people around him.
Well, I'm sure we can infer, though, from the dialogues that Plato has this kind of program of convert the leader and they will set an example for the subordinate leaders. And then once you have enough transformation in the elites, they set the example for the rest of the population. Now, whether or not that's a good strategy is a different question, but that I think is the intended aim here is that, and this is still an attitude we have today. I'd be curious to know if you find this in Canada, but there's this sense that the head of state in a nation, part of their function is to represent or express the soul of the nation. And so Plato is sort of thinking, like, oh, then if that's where the soul is, change the soul, and that will filter out into the rest of the nation. Now, certainly he would advocate for education for the wider population in virtue, not just the leader, but he thinks, I suspect, that if the leader hasn't bought into that education regime, they're probably not going to authorize it for the rest of the population.
Yeah, it's a really good observation, actually. The historical way that we have seen the head of state as being the, representative of the spirit and the soul of the state, and supposedly should be somebody good, well behaved, and a model for citizens to follow. It doesn't always work out that way. And I think, I guess in this world now where we have almost 8 billion people on this planet, many, many, many times more than existed when Plato wrote 2,400 years ago. I guess the problem becomes even larger in terms of, there's many leaders. I think there's close to 200 nations on Earth, all with, differing approaches and views and histories. And yeah, the idea of trying to instill some virtue in the system so that virtuous people can select virtuous leaders seems like a huge project now. So one thing that I wanted to pick up on too was near the end of that part that I read, where he says, "These cities are always changing into tyrannies or oligarchies or democracies, while the rulers of them will not even hear mention of a just and equitable constitution." And that, I guess, is another reference to the Republic when he talked about the four imperfect societies, I think they were called in the Republic. That this change always seems to happen in history. Democracy gives way to tyranny and oligarchy, and I guess we still see that, don't we, in 2,400 years later.
Yeah, we're seeing it on the global stage in a really significant way over the past 8 years that, a philosopher I really like, Slavoj Žižek, made this observation a while back that since World War II, the word democracy has almost lost its meaning because everybody thinks of themselves as a democracy. And he pointed to North Korea and he says, what's the actual name of it? Well, it's the People's Democratic Republic of North Korea or whatever. And so even they think they're a democracy. And so if we get behind the rhetoric and the labels and we actually look at the character of these nations, what we do see is this kind of cyclical effect where There's a sort of rise and fall of power consolidated around a single leader, consolidated around a group of plutocrats, consolidated around democratic factions, and in this kind of wheel. Now, there was a fourth government that Plato mentions in the Republic, which is where you have a military dictatorship. And there are still a few of those here and there. Thailand's a good place to look if you want some representations of that. But military dictatorships have become a little bit less common in recent history. But those other three, the plutocratic society, the democratic society, and the totalitarian society, very much alive and well, and we tend to oscillate between them.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's because of that factionalism again that people break into groups, tribes, and they start competing with each other. And that erodes the democratic spirit. And as you say, we still use the word democracy, but is it really democracy? It actually makes me think, you know, I mentioned that section that I was thinking of starting our next discussion on. And at 342 B, this is what makes me really think this is Plato. He says, "For every real being, there are three things that are necessary if knowledge of it is to be acquired. First, the name, so democracy. Second, the definition. Third, the image. Knowledge comes fourth. In the fifth place, we must put the object itself, the noble and truly real being." So I think maybe we use the word democracy, but we've sort of, as you said, I think lost the definition of what that is. And I think he's reminding us in that sentence that I just read, that we have to continually look at the words and understand their meanings if we're going to practice them. And when we don't practice democracy, but we're still calling ourselves democracies, it leads to, I think, a vicious spiral, really, that it's engendering more destructive behavior. I think that if people were simply to stop and think about that definition, but also to think about the historical process of how democracies crumble in history. I said, and I think in our last discussion, that I think the teaching of history is very important, and that I don't think it's been given its due now. But I think if history were taught, we would see many cases of democracies giving way to tyrannies. As you said in the outset, democratic Athens gave way to the tyranny of the 30. So I think history gives these lessons, and I think maybe he's appealing to our sense of history.
Yeah, if listeners aren't aware of this, there's a sense in which the rise of the 30 tyrants in Athens was a sort of micro version of what happened in Germany between the world wars, because it was the same kind of thing where Sparta had sacked Athens. Athens was in a state of real economic turmoil. There was a lot of hardship, a lot of shame by the people. And so, just like that kind of mood within Germany created the conditions for the rise of the Third Reich, so in Athens, it created the kind of conditions for a sort of select elite to have absolute power to save our nation state and bring us back to glory. And we hear that kind of rhetoric even today about we got to get back to what was great about our nation. And of course, that's fantasy. That's not reality. And the quote you just read, Plato is really highlighting that if you want justice in a society, you have to care about what's real, not about the fantasy that some politician is trying to sell you. And just to connect that to the passage that we've been looking at here, when you read the part where he's sort of lamenting the state of politics in his days, and he says, "I was forced to say, in praise of true philosophy, that from her height alone was it possible to discern what the nature of justice is, either in the state or in the individual." Plato there is not, contrary to some popular mischaracterizations, he is not giving this elitist ivory tower top-down analysis, like let the elites come in and tell you what justice is. No, he's saying until all of us become people who are able to look at justice from the philosophical spirit, that means not allied with a particular faction, not trying to secure advantage for ourselves, not trying to make sure that our enemies get punished, but simply out of a love for the truth about justice, only then are we going to even know what kind of politics should we try to pursue. So this is simply his way of advocating for the truth of justice as against the success or advantage of any particular faction or ruler or class of elites.
You make some really good points there. I think first you said that people are now looking to the past for greatness. What if greatness lies in the future, not in the past? It's hard without a cohesive society. It's hard, I guess, to plan for a great future. And so we only look back at what we think was, but people's perceptions of what existed in the past are very different. A lot of people would say that things may not have been so great in the past, and those wanting to make things great again maybe have a different, not complete view of what the past was like. So, again, the necessity of teaching history, I think, is important, and especially important as you described Athens being punished and then reacting against that punishment. As you mentioned, the connection to Germany between the two wars. Well, Germany, after World War I, was punished heavily, driven into huge debt by the Treaty of Versailles. The victors of that battle were out to punish Germany. And it was a terrible time in Germany. Hyperinflation broke out. Living conditions were terrible. And a proud nation was brought to its knees. And it was ripe for a tyrant like Hitler to come along and promise, I will make things better for you. And so Hitler didn't make things better for Germany or 60 million people who died in that war. But the interesting thing was that after World War II, a different approach was taken. And it's more like the approach I think that Plato talks about in this letter, that the victor is not just powerful militarily, but powerful morally. And I think the approach that was taken after World War II in helping to rebuild Germany with the Marshall Plan and all the efforts, I think that paid huge dividends, huge dividends. And so instead of a nation destroyed and one that's seeking to regain its power and revenge, you had a productive nation grow out of it. And I think that was a really interesting connection to the lesson I think that Plato's trying to say here about how victors, about how the powerful should behave. Well, why don't we go on to the second reading if you maybe would like to do that? This is a selection that we chose from 330D to 331A.
Do you want to just elaborate on the subtitle you have there? And you're making a connection there. I'm not sure what you're referring to, but go ahead and elaborate for the listeners, and then I'll read the passage.
Well, I thought this section kind of foreshadowed some recent events. I won't get too specific about that. And sometimes, and with some people, philosophy falls upon deaf ears. That was my subtitle.
When one is advising a sick man who is living in a way injurious to his health, must one not first of all tell him to change his way of life and give him further counsel only if he is willing to obey? If he is not, I think any manly and self-respecting physician would break off counseling such a man, whereas anyone who would put up with him is without spirit or skill. So, too, with respect to a city, whether it be governed by one man or many, if its constitution is properly ordered and rightly directed, it would be sensible to give advice to its citizens concerning what would be to the city's advantage. But if it is a people who have wandered completely away from right government and resolutely refuse to come back upon its track and instruct their counselor to leave the Constitution strictly alone, threatening him with death if he changes it, and order him instead to serve their interests and desires and show them how they can henceforth satisfy them in the quickest and easiest way. Any man, I think, who would accept such a role as advisor is without spirit, and he who refuses is the true man. These are my principles, and whenever anyone consults me on a question of importance in his life, such as the making of money or the care of his body or soul, If it appears to me that he follows some plan in his daily life or is willing to listen to reason on the matters he lays before me, I advise him gladly and don't stop with merely discharging my duty. But a man who does not consult me at all, or makes it clear that he will not follow advice that is given him, to such a man I do not take it upon myself to offer counsel, nor would I use constraint upon him, not even if he were my own son. If they are fixed in a way of life that pleases them, though it may not please me, I should not antagonize them by useless admonitions, nor yet by flattery and complaisance, encourage them in the satisfaction of desires that I would die rather than embrace. This is the principle which a wise man must follow in his relations towards his own city. Let him warn her if he thinks her constitution is corrupt, and there is a prospect that his words will be listened to and not put him in danger of his life. But let him not use violence upon his fatherland to bring about a change of constitution. If what he thinks is best can only be accomplished by the exile and slaughter of men, let him keep his peace and pray for the welfare of himself and his city.
Wow, that's powerful. That line, especially, I would die rather than embrace this complacence. Yeah, it really reminds me again of Socrates, that Socrates was given the chance to escape. He didn't escape. He didn't retaliate. He took what they thought was justice, and he demonstrated for all time what justice is not. Justice is not what was done to Socrates. Really interesting section there. And the part where he says, any man I think who would accept such a role as advisor is without spirit, and he refuses is the true man, really makes me think of Dion versus Dionysius. Dion maybe is the true man in this sense, and that Dionysius is the one who just refuses to open his eyes.
Yeah, this is such an interesting passage because, again, this is one of those places where I wish people would see the pragmatism of Plato as an idealist, because what he's saying here is, I will do all that I can to help you and your city achieve justice. But if you come to me and say, we're unwilling to change, we're unwilling to do what it takes to bring about justice. And in fact, what we really want is just to have our desires satisfied in the quickest way possible. Then there's nothing I can do for you. And I would draw the attention to the beginning of this passage where he makes one of his many, many favorite analogies to the physician. He says, if you go to the doctor and the doctor says, well, here's the disease you have and here's the treatment, and you say, yeah, but I'd prefer to treat the disease without the treatment. Can you like just get rid of this without me having to go through the treatment regime? The physician's going to say, I don't know what else to do for you. Like, I can help you get well. But what I can't do is, work a bit of magic so that you're not inconvenienced or you don't have to change your life in order to get healthy again.
That's a great mention of his many references to the medical analogy. And again, a sign that this is really, I think, the voice of Plato. Yeah, it's interesting because, when I think of modern times, this line that you read, but if it is a people who have wandered completely away from right government and resolutely refuse to come back upon its track and instruct their counselor to leave the Constitution strictly alone, threatening him with death if he changes it, and order him instead to serve their interests and desires and show them how they can henceforth satisfy them in the quickest and easy way. Any man, I think, who would accept such a role as advisor is without spirit, and he who refuses is the true man. So, again, this kind of excess, the society that's living in these excesses is not looking for right government. It's looking for government that satisfies their needs, but it's not right government. And this, again, I think is very reminiscent of Plato's laws, where he says that the good society is a society that values virtue. And so when he says right government here, I think he's talking about virtue. He doesn't use the word virtue in this particular sentence, but what do you think?
Yes, right government and and also the ideal of government. That's why I think it's both. It's the type of society that he's represents in the Kallipolis and that he lays out a programmatic plan for in Magnesia. Those are supposed to be paradigms of right government. And so he's saying these are people who are walking away from justice, away from virtue, and they resolutely refuse to come back. And so, in that case, the right thing to do is to refuse service, to refuse complicity. And one of the things I like about the way he's written this is it's not just about refusing unlawful orders. It's also about refusing orders that might be consistent with the law but are against virtue, the higher law, as Martin Luther King Jr. would famously call it. And of course, refusing to do so might result in your death. It did for Socrates, for certain. And what I love about this letter and the historical context that I laid for us is Plato has real skin in the game. You know, I mean, not when he's writing this letter, but when he was in Syracuse and he was refusing both Dionysius the First and then later Dionysius the Second, you know, he actually faced real material repercussions for his refusal. So we should read this not just as a statement of Plato's principles from the ivory tower, from the armchair. No, this is actually the statement of somebody who was in the trenches trying to bring about change and who was threatened with real political violence when he refused.
Yeah, he's applying practical philosophy. He's no longer just a theorist. He's practicing it, and he's showing us the problems in the practice, the problems that you run up into with people who are driven by factions, like to live in excess, don't refer to reason in their living. I mean, it's one of the things that I guess concerns me about the current political environment around the world, in my country as well, is that leaders don't really anymore talk about virtue. You mentioned Martin Luther King. I mean, there was somebody who, whether you agree with him or not, he has a sense of justice, and he tried to get people to talk about justice as others did in that time in the 1960s. And here we are now. And I mean, I'm facing an election. I'm voting next week in my province. And has there been any talk about virtue or justice or any of these things? It's all just talking about transactions, the economy, and all of this. But you know, where's the bigger picture? I think that's really the thing. And he uses the word reason here, where he says that these are my principles, and whenever anyone consults me on a question of importance in his life, such as the making of money or the care of his body and soul, if it appears to me that he follows some plan in his daily life or is willing to listen to reason on the matters he lays before me, I advise him gladly and don't stop with merely discharging my duty. So it's just listening to reason. I guess maybe has reason sort of departed, or has reason sort of been discounted in our modern politics?
Yeah, as some of your listeners may know, I write a Substack, Plato for the Masses, and an essay that will be out by the time that this recording is uploaded to Plato's Pod. Is I'm talking about how democratic electorates, we don't vote typically with our heads or even with our hearts. We vote with our guts. And what I mean by that's kind of a shorthand for saying that the thing that really moves electoral outcomes is not that we all get together and exchange reasons. And it's not that we get together and empathically try to understand each other and overcome these differences. We, as a mass people, tend to vote on the basis of vibes. On sentiments, on moods, on the, you know, the we vote for people who make us feel safe or who sound like they're going to stomp all over our political enemies or whatever it is that is driving the current political climate. And that kind of making political decisions with your gut is the kind of thing that really horrifies Plato because there's no wisdom in your gut. So.
Yeah, exactly. And we react very quickly now, thanks to technology and social media platforms in particular. I've written about this in the Quantum Record many times, that we don't stop to reflect anymore. Very little reflection happens now compared to, when I was growing up 30 and 40 years ago, there was no social media. If you wanted to get a political point across, you had to get yourself on radio or television. You had to buy an advertisement. It would have to take time to disseminate. People would think about it, talk about it. There was that time for reflection. It was because the technology wasn't there to give us that instant reaction. Whereas now it's this instant reaction. And I think that's driving things very much more towards, as you say, voting on vibes, voting based on the gut, voting based on emotions, not thinking ahead, not thinking about the greatness that could lie ahead. And we simply cannot think of the future. We just have to find ourselves replicating the past because we're just reacting too quickly to even stop and reflect. Is what we're doing correct? Does this make sense? Why weren't we doing this, 30 years ago? Maybe there was a good reason we weren't doing this 30 years ago. So I think technology has really inserted itself in the political process now that's really taken away that need to discuss reason.
Yeah, well said. Well said. I'd like to, if you don't mind, raise a kind of puzzle for us to ruminate on here, because the end of this section is Plato giving advice to fellow philosophers on what to do. And he says, warn the city if you think that the city. And city here, we would think of as nation. If you think the city or the nation is corrupt and there is a prospect that your words will be listened to. Okay, so there has to be some reasonable expectation of success that you're not just shouting into the void. Okay. But then he says, if there isn't, if you do not think that reason is going to get a foothold in your society and have an effect on the outcome of the state. He says, quote, "Let him not use violence upon his fatherland to bring about a change of constitution. If what he thinks is best can only be accomplished by the exile and slaughter of men, let him keep his peace and pray for the welfare of himself and his city." Now, that's a really amazing passage because he is very explicitly, I think, counseling that the philosopher cannot participate in a violent revolution to overthrow the dictator. Now, that's interesting for multiple reasons. One is that's sort of what Dion did, right? Dion raised an army eventually and went in and sacked Syracuse and took it over. So we might be thinking about when he comments on those sections of the story in his letter, what he really thinks about all of this action. But the other reason I wanted to bring this up is there's a little bit of a tension between what he says here and something that he writes in the laws. And we don't know the exact order of these things because a lot of scholars think Plato was working on the laws right up to the last days of his life, in which case it's possible that this passage was written after he writes this letter. But it could be before too, so we don't really know. But in the laws at 770 D and E, he has this passage where he says he's describing something very similar, that the goal of the philosopher is to counsel the city and the leaders of the city and all the citizens of the city to work towards virtue. And he says, whatever the means, it's this aim we've described that we must all strain every muscle to achieve throughout our lives. No man, whoever he is, should ever be found valuing anything else if it impedes his progress. Not even, in the last resort, the state. Rather than have the state tolerate the yoke of slavery and be ruled by unworthy hands, it may be absolutely necessary to allow it to be destroyed or abandon it by going into exile. All that sort of hardship we simply have to endure, rather than permit a change to the sort of political system which will make men worse. End quote. So I just what I want to highlight there is in that passage, and of course this is in the mouth of the Athenian, so we're not getting Plato's voice directly, and we have to always hold that in mind, that he is a dialectician first, not a didactic writer. But nonetheless, here we have the Athenian and his interlocutors sort of raising this principle that you have such a duty to the common good that you can't even let the state itself become a source of despotism and subjugation. And so the Athenian does say, rather than let the state tolerate the yoke of slavery and be ruled by unworthy hands, it may be necessary to allow it to be destroyed or abandon it by going into exile. Now, neither of those two things are straightforward political revolution. It's certainly not of the kind that, Karl Marx was famous for discussing. But I am intrigued by what he means by abandoning it by going into exile. That means something like, get off the ship, go somewhere else. That's consistent, I think, with the letter. But this idea of allowing the city to be destroyed rather than permit a change to the sort of political system which will make men worse. I'm not quite sure what is meant by that, because there does seem to be some sense in which we are envisioning a more forceful standing up for, say, the capture of the state by a tyrant than allow it to fall into unworthy hands. I'm just curious what you make of the tension between that passage in the laws and this passage here in the seventh letter.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but I do recall now that passage from the Laws. And as you say, it isn't Plato speaking in the Laws. He puts the words in the mouth of the Athenian. And a number of times during our discussion that's on the Laws, I had my doubts about the Athenian and his motives. I'm not sure that the Athenian. I don't agree with what the Athenian said in some cases, but I think the Athenian maybe was saying that to test the other two characters. So that could be possible. I'm wondering too, when he says the city destroy, is it maybe talking about the city destroy itself, to let the city destroy itself rather than to actively destroy the city? I'm wondering if maybe that's part of what the Athenian might be saying there. I don't know. Could the words be read that way?
I'll read it again. I mean, it's so interesting the way that, like, the grammar that Plato has in his mouth here. He says, rather than have the state tolerate the yoke of slavery and be ruled by unworthy hands, it may be absolutely necessary to allow it to be destroyed. So there is clearly this contrast. I don't think he's saying we just let it fall into unworthy hands and destroy itself, at least not in that sense. Now, there may be another form of self-destruction that he's contemplating. And what one thing that I was thinking actually would be something like a constitutional crisis, sort of like what happened in the United States with the Articles of Confederation, where they got together and said, this isn't working. This was in 1787. This isn't working. We're going to tear up the laws that are currently bind us, and we're going to convene a convention, and we're going to try to find another way of doing this. But the implied condition there was, if we don't, that's the end of the United States. Do you see what I'm getting at there? And I'm wondering if Plato's envisioning something like that, where all those who have any modicum of political power, they come together and sort of say, like, we're not handing the state over to these people because they're awful. And so if you all go ahead with giving them power, we're tearing this experiment up. And like the state will cease to exist because we're no longer going to be subject to its laws. But the thing is, if you do that, it just seems to me like some form of political revolution becomes inevitable because you're standing up to the tyrants. And I just wonder if at that point some form of armed revolt becomes inevitable.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. The idea of a revolution. Now, maybe there's a bloody revolution versus a revolution where you just simply let things fall apart. And yeah, it's interesting. I'd like to see the original words in Greek for that. When he says allow it to be destroyed, he's not saying to destroy it. He says allow it to be. So
That's right. That's right.
it's interesting, very interesting. And as you point out, Dion actually did take an active role. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting contrast, what we're supposed to believe. Well, again, Plato says in this letter that he never puts his opinions on paper. You can't put your dearest things, your most precious things, opinions. You cannot, they just simply cannot be put on paper. And he said this, I guess, at one point, Dionysius was supposed to have written down Plato's teachings and disseminated them. And Plato says, no, that wasn't me, because I never do that sort of thing.
That's right. Yeah. Plato always maintains and prioritizes the dialectic over the didactic, meaning for him, you have to learn through your own investigation. I can't tell you. And only, I can model a dialogue for you, and that's what the dialogues are, but I can't give you the answer key. This is very intuitive. When I was in high school, we used to have those math workbooks where there would be an answer key at the back of the book. And I could look at the math problem and then I could flip to the back of the book and get the answer, but that's not doing mathematics. And in the same way, Plato is saying to do philosophy and to do politics, you have to learn to think for yourself. You can't just come to me and ask for all the answers. But back to this question here, just on this letter. I am really struck by this line where he says, if what he thinks is best can only be accomplished by the exile and slaughter of men, let him keep his peace and pray for the welfare of himself and his city. I think one lesson that I take away with that, regardless of this little tension with that passage in the Laws, is Plato loves his neighbor. And I think he's saying here, the true philosopher always loves their neighbor. And if you come to a point where you think you're loving your neighbor by slaughtering your neighbor, you're not loving your neighbor. You need to rethink what you're doing.
Yeah, that's a great point. Love your neighbor. And it actually makes me think of the very beginning of this letter where he's recounting his history in Athens, and he says one of the bad things that happened is that they tried to make Socrates be part of a jury that would condemn another man. And Socrates would have this is not Socrates. This is not the way Socrates behaves. They tried to compel him to do that. So it's, again, this not demonstrating this virtue of loving your neighbor, giving understanding to people. They did it with an agenda, and there was going to be no other choice given to Socrates. And this is just simply not what Socrates as a virtuous man would do.
Yeah, what you're describing was an event that would foreshadow the kinds of things that happened in Stalinist Soviet Union, where you would have mock trials, where there's the veneer of a judge and lawyers and whatnot, but really the state is just rigging charges to execute political opponents. And Socrates was a well-known war hero. A lot of people don't know this. Before he became the philosopher that we all know and love, he had a life. And one of the things was he was involved in the Peloponnesian War, and he was a very skilled warrior and kind of mid-level leader of men. And so he had a lot of respect and political and social capital in the city. And the tyrants were trying to strong arm him into giving false testimony against another war general, somebody that they were opposed to. And the reason they wanted Socrates to do it is because his opinion carried weight. If Socrates says this guy did it, then that gives the air of legitimacy. And Socrates wouldn't do it. He, again, like this passage says, he refused and therefore was the true man. And a lot of scholars think that this was the beginning of the growing antipathy against Socrates in the city, that they started spreading malicious lies about him. And eventually, this is what led to the trumped up charges against Socrates himself, in which he found himself in front of a mock trial that led to his capital punishment.
Socrates would rather have suffered that punishment than to do wrong to somebody else. That's the key, and that comes through in all of Plato's writings about Socrates. I wanted to ask, maybe just before we wind up this particular session, so Plato addressed this letter to the friends of Dion, and I'm curious, I don't know who these friends were, how widely dispersed they were they all in Syracuse, were they elsewhere? Do we know anything about these friends of Dion?
We know some. I don't have a cast of characters ready to hand, but I do know generally that Dion was well connected, well traveled. He had allies in Syracuse, but he also had allies all over Italy and Greece. And when he died, he had estates and property that he had purchased all over. And so there was a discussion amongst his friends of how to disperse these things. Like they wanted to make sure that his family was taken care of. And then they wanted to make sure that the things that were his didn't fall into the hands of his assassin, essentially the new ruler of Syracuse. And so there were people who were part of a shared community that Plato was a part of who wanted to do something that I think is familiar to all of us today, which is we don't want Dion's death to be in vain, right? We don't want him to have died for nothing. And so we don't know what correspondence Plato was responding to, but the implication that he gives in this letter is that he's been contacted by these people wanting to know. First of all, what went wrong? Like, how did we end up here? And two, what next? There's this very clear overriding theme to this letter that they have asked him, what do we do now so that Dion did not die in vain? And so that's kind of the impetus of this, I think, is that they're not like a society of friends or anything like, they're not a formal organization, but they are people who want to rectify this in some way, this injustice that they've experienced of their friend's untimely death. And they're not trying to rectify it by raising up another army. They're looking for how do we live in this world that does the kinds of things that we just witnessed were done to Dion.
It's and actually makes me think that again this this contrast of Dionysius having no friends but ruling by terror, whereas Dion has these friends. And so Dion, even though he's dead, he's richer for these relationships, and the memory of Dion goes on. Really interesting. I didn't appreciate that history, so thank you. And that's actually a good segue into, I think, what we want to talk about next time. And that's the question of can virtue be taught? And we'll see. We have a number of readings. Maybe I'll just, because we kind of touched upon it, I'm just going to read three lines that I selected for the first reading for that theme. This is at 332C. I just love this. How do we recognize virtue? He says, but Dionysius, though he united all Sicily into a single city, for he knew that he could trust no one, was scarcely able to survive, for he was poor in friends and loyal followers, and the possession or lack of these is the best indication of a man's virtue or vice. I love that. And maybe that's an indication of Dion being the more virtuous, clearly, in this case.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's almost like when he says friends, he's not talking about sycophants, which is a major problem that we have in our political world today, where people don't have friends, they have transactional partners. And that's not what he's talking about here. He's when he says friends and loyal followers, he's talking about love. Again, for me, so much of Plato comes back to love. He's talking about people who love each other and are willing to die for each other. And he's saying, If you have people like that in your life, that's evidence of your virtue. And if you don't, you should probably rethink the way you've been living.
Yeah, powerful, powerful. And again, makes me think of, that discussion that happened throughout the 1960s, people like Martin Luther King that had real friends and real followers who truly believed in them with their hearts and their minds. And it wasn't just this gut following that we have now, I think is, it's an interesting point, as we look at politicians now, maybe an interesting way to gauge their virtue is to look at who are the actual friends of these people. And if we don't find any real friends, if we just find the sycophants that you talked about, then that's not the politician that we want. That's a person who professes strength but actually is weak in terms of ability to lead people truly by reason.
Well said.
Well, that's great. It's been a fantastic discussion. It again, I just love bringing Plato into the 21st century because, as somebody said to me a few weeks ago, why would I want to read Plato? It's so old. It's, why wouldn't I want to read modern philosophy? Well, I find just so many resonances in Plato's words that really just apply to the human condition now as much as it did back then. And I think Letter 7 is really an important, it's almost a parable, I think, of how a philosopher can interact with a society and the good things that can happen and the dangers that can happen. And Dion was a good thing and Dionysus was the danger. It's been great chatting and very much looking forward to our next session on the subject of can virtue be taught. And I do want to start with that section that I mentioned from about 341b, which really is Plato talking about his own personal approach and the fact that he does not project his ideas onto other people. And that's maybe a sign of his virtue.
Sounds good, James. I look forward to it.
Yeah, looking forward to it very much. Well, thanks, Michael, and we'll talk to you very soon. Looking forward to the next episode.